You're listening to a podcast from 702.
McLaugh, thank you so much for staying with us on the show. Plenty for us to get our teeth sunk into, so many political, economic and other issues that are in the news. Some issues are also under the radar. There is a story, of course, that some of you are aware of, but maybe not all of you. And again, the right to die is a topic that has surfaced, and it raises ethical and legal questions about what our attitude should be, including our law, and what the law should say about the possibility of active euthanasia or assisted dying. And this is after Dignity SA founder, and Dignity SA works on this space and campaigns for law reform and also for social attitudes to change in the direction of approving of assisted dying, obviously under certain circumstances. And the founder, Professor Sean Davison, reportedly has now accepted a plea deal with the state that will see him serve 3 years under house arrest in exchange for pleading guilty to 3 counts of murder. And some folks had hoped that this issue will go to trial and maybe that will spur on law reform in that direction. And some may be disappointed by the decision that he had taken. But as he has said, and this is quoted in many reports, and I quote, "My children want a father, not a martyr." And then there's some of you who are disappointed in the opposite direction, who thinks that he is a murderer and that, quite frankly, house arrest is inappropriate under the circumstances. But Judge John Schlope doesn't think so. Under exceptional circumstances, there can be a deviation from even the minimal sentencing guidelines for murder, even if there are compelling reasons to depart from those sentencing guidelines. And on this occasion, that is exactly what the court had decided, as did the court, of course, in Dunedin in New Zealand, where Professor Davison was born after he had been charged with the murder of his terminally ill mother, Dr. Patricia Ferguson, after administering her with a lethal dose of morphine on her request. And one of the icons that have supported him in terms of the entire campaign of Dignity SA all along has been Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who himself has publicly said that he would like the option of ending his own life through assisted dying. So assisted dying throws up all sorts of ethical as well as legal quandaries. And I wonder whether you and I can enter into a sensible conversation. And I say sensible because I think this is one of those ethical conversations where many of us have got deep intuitions, very deeply held beliefs and hardwired, maybe through socialization, intuitions about what is wrong and what is right, what can and what can the state not allow us to do, what should public policy be on this matter. And on a very personal level, I want to know what your personal reflections are. Would you like that option for yourself? So there's a public policy part of this discussion, and then there's a deeply personal part. And I'll tell you my view, because I'm not neutral on this matter. I want the option of assisted dying for myself. There are certain qualities of life I do not want to live. If my body, my brain gets to a certain state, while I'm compos mentis, may need to already make sure that I have a living will that reflects that desire. But you now know it. You've heard it here on the Eusebius MacIsaac show. My family will know it. If they haven't previously, they do now. I don't want to live until my body decides that it's now packing up officially. There's a certain quality of life that expresses deeply my sense of who I am as a person, as Eusebius MacIsaac in the world. And I would like to have a say in terms of my autonomy about when and how it is I want to leave planet Earth. And I know that if, for example, there are certain speech functions I no longer have, neurological conditions, mobility that is reduced either through an accident or I get diagnosed with a certain condition, I don't want to live a certain quality of life. And for me, the issue is, on a personal level, who the hell is the state? And who are you as a bystander to be making that decision for me? So that's where I come from as Eusebius. And if you've never given it thought, give it some thought, and then give us a call and let us know what your reflections are as you listen to me and my guest, Jacques Rousseau, who is no stranger to this show. We'll always bring Jacques in for these tricky issues that require critical thinking and deep ethical consideration, and that's what he specializes in at the University of Cape Town. Jacques, good morning to you, my friend, and thanks for coming on the show again.
Good morning, Cedric. It's good to be with you.
I'm not even going to structure this one the way you and I, as philosophers, like to have highly structured conversations. Let's talk about it dynamically. I know how much you support Dignity SA. Before we talk about the law or public policy, maybe let me ask you on a personal level for yourself as well as Jacques. Do you want the option for yourself of a sister dying?
I certainly do. And I mean, I would go further than many advocates and say that I would want the option even if I was just bored of life. I wouldn't even need to be terminally ill or something like that. But of course, that's not an attitude that I'm going to push for.
Yeah.
That's certainly what I would want to do.
And tell me why that is the case, because for a lot of people, and this gets us into the first ethical issue, for a lot of people, I think they may not express it in these terms, but when you tease out discomfort with a sister dying, for some people it's because they think that life is intrinsically valuable.
That's right. No, I mean, I think there are two ways of framing that. And the one would be the sort of theologically driven one, where people talk about how life isn't yours to give or take away. But there's, I think, a secular version of that as well, and the one that I'm sympathetic to, which is just the idea that there's something valuable in society to have a default attitude of respect and admiration and concern for maintaining life. And we should try to preserve it, in a sense, at all costs.
Mm.
I think that viewpoint is flawed, because what it misses is that sometimes we respect life the most by doing what you were alluding to in your intro, by respecting people's wishes in terms of how they would like to live their lives, and that includes how they would like to end their life. Keeping people alive through suffering doesn't sound consistent to me with respecting life.
I think so, and I was thinking about it this morning again as I was reading Rebecca Davis's report on this issue in Daily Maverick, reading your wonderful, pithy, but really excellent little piece on your platform, synapsis.co.za. And I was, you kind of like revisit your own intuitions. My intuitions haven't changed, nor my considered view on the matter. But what I want to emphasize maybe might shift if I give it some more thought. Previously, we've often framed this discussion, as you say, even in terms of suffering and quality of life. But I thought to myself this morning, actually, there's a more fundamental premise here for me that I probably would now foreground first, and maybe I wouldn't have foregrounded this one first 20 years ago. And it's actually the autonomy one. I mean, we can't pretend, surely, as a society founded on liberal democratic values in particular, that we genuinely want to give expression so far as possible the maximum possible allowance for autonomy, and yet want to dictate how you should live before we even get to suffering.
Well, more than just forcing telling you how you should live, it's telling you that you are duty bound to live regardless of anything.
Yes, it's compulsory to be alive.
And at the same time, we let people do madly dangerous things like rock climbing or driving their cars on racetracks too fast or whatever. We let people do things that risk their lives. But this is, I suppose, something that you can't insure for. There's no money to be made out of it.
Yes.
There's a complete lack of respect for autonomy here, and the reasons are grounded in a really old notion of the sanctity of life, the sacredness of life. And that is a idea which doesn't really have a place in society anymore, but it's going to take a long time to undo its power.
I think there's an elephant here that you and I will obviously point out. I don't know if you'll agree with me. You are slightly nicer than me about some of these things in philosophy of religion. I think one of the things that is in the background are religious-inspired ideas about life for its own sake. And I think some of people's squeamishness or lack of willingness to examine their view about a sister dying is because they will say things like, we shouldn't play God.
Yeah, even our health minister said exactly the same thing a few years back. And the thing is that the problem, we play God all the time. So you take antibiotics, but that is playing God. So God there was trying to kill you and you defeated her wishes by taking the antibiotics.
That's true.
And for some reason, that's fine. When I wear spectacles or contact lenses, I'm playing God because I was designed to be run over by cars, apparently. So there's yes. one way in which we cannot play God. But in all other respects, we're allowed to play God, flying in airplanes, driving in cars, you know, all of these sorts of things. So that is a fundamental principle that isn't being challenged. And I mean, the second thing to be charitable, like you accused me, well, like you said I was going to be, the second thing is that people are very worried, and again, I would want to say justifiably, about those slippery slope sorts of concerns that we're going to start, you know, ending the lives of people who are really inconvenient.
I want to get to that in a second, because I think particularly okay. in a country like ours, for me, that is the most serious public policy concern. But we'll get to that. I want to first deal flesh out some of these principled issues. You know, it's interesting on the autonomy principle. When, to the extent that as a society we do try to improve the law and social and public policy to allow people maximum autonomy, it is in relation to life but not the process of dying and death itself. So we might be able to tell a story why cheating is wrong. If you cheat on your lover, you are subverting their autonomy because you are bypassing an opportunity for them to consent or to withhold consent for you to sleep with another person. So it's fairly easy with a little bit of training to teach you to describe why disrespecting someone's autonomy is unethical. But we seem to have, and I don't know if you agree with me, we seem to have this weird inconsistency that autonomy can often make an appearance in court cases, in public debates about large areas of our life, and yet when it comes to the end stage of our life, we suddenly want it to be outside of the room.
Yeah, that's true, but I think that if we were to fish for some sort of plausible or charitable reading of this, we'd say that this exercise of autonomy could leave people behind who suffer unduly because of it, and you in a sense don't get a chance to make amends or to fix the problems you've left behind. So we're worried about people checking out and leaving dependent families behind, and they haven't made plans, they haven't put their affairs in order and that sort of thing. So that would be the non-religious argument for why this particular choice of autonomy would be a poor one to make. But as I was indicating earlier on, I don't think that that's consistent because of all the ways in which we allow for autonomy to cause us to put our lives at serious risk.
Yeah.
So we want to control all aspects of that chain, I think, if we were to take this principle seriously.
Absolutely. 19 minutes after 10 o'clock, if you've just joined us, we're talking about the right to die. Do you think that the law is antiquated in South Africa? Active euthanasia or assisted dying should be allowed. There's a public policy element to that, but there's also a deeply personal question I'm asking of you this morning. Do you want that option for yourself? I want that option for me. And I think there's something really perverse about a nanny state deciding for me how I should leave planet Earth. If I want to check out, why not? And I think public policy here needs to take seriously my autonomy. You can't simultaneously say that you take my wishes seriously as a person. It goes to the heart of my individuality and personhood. Autonomy, it's an important value in our constitution. It is infused throughout our jurisprudence. And yet at the same time, we have this incredible, incredible odd understanding of the way in which autonomy as a value should or shouldn't make an appearance in discussion specifically about assisted dying. Tell me your viewpoint, your experiences maybe with loved ones. Have you seen them suffering? Have you wished you've had that option? Have you ever a loved one express such a desire? But you know, under current law, you could face a murder charge if you were to help them out. That's exactly what Professor Davison has been experiencing. 072-702-1702. You can leave me your stories or as a WhatsApp note, or you can also just call me on 011-883-0702. 21 minutes after 10.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 for the curious.
I think this for me the most serious problem isn't a principled problem in jurisprudence or in ethics. It's actually a practical problem, Jacques, that and you already alluded to it. And I think those of us who are in support of assisted dying, we've got to take this seriously. How do we deal with the public policy conundrum that in a country where you have deep inequality, incredible levels of poverty, got families that are torn apart for whatever reasons, how do we prevent pernicious cases? Because once someone is dead, they can't say, I didn't want the lethal cocktail.
Yeah, well, so you'd have to start out with perhaps far more draconian checks and balances than you would ideally like to try to safeguard against that. So all of the states where the U.S. has medically assisted suicide in the 4 years states. The regulations are nearly identical. You need to have a 2 oral and 1 written request to a physician and have been told that you've got less than 6 months to live. More general principles in a society like ours, you'd make that even stronger. You'd say 3 different physicians, independent of each other, need to express a view. So those can be state doctors or whatever. And a specialist, and you need a psychiatrist, a final fit, et cetera. So of course that is going to make it difficult for some people who don't have access to that, to have access to those services. But we have the same problem with things like abortion or gay marriage or whatever. And in time, the state will hopefully provide that more equitably. But in the meanwhile, people who are trying to cheat the system will get caught out, and people who want to get a dignified death will be able to access that.
Okay, so it is not a fundamental reason to not have the policy. It just means that the work in terms of the quality of legislators needs to be done, can look at international comparative cases to make sure that you have the best possible practical safeguards that you have in the policy. But it's not a slam dunk reason to not have the policy enacted. Is that what you're saying?
I'm precisely saying that. I mean, so we, of course, are going to get some false positives slipping through the cracks. So you might get one or two, but that I want to stress to listeners is offset by the fact that we are getting so many people having access to a dignified death. So if we shouldn't judge a policy by its exceptions.
Yeah.
We should judge by what it does on the whole,
yeah.
You know, the utilitarian calculus.
Absolutely.
And then, yes, as you were just pointing out, it's not an argument for not allowing it to anybody that we aren't allowed or that we aren't able to provide it to everybody, at least in the short term.
Dylan and Dumisani, I'm going to take your calls in a second. Can I just give you a minute or less, Jacques, to introduce another value? We've spoken about autonomy. There's a reason why Dignity SA has the word dignity in there. Why is dignity important? What does it mean? And how does it feature in this discussion? You've also referenced it in your last remarks.
So people who live for years in extreme suffering, let's imagine you can't even speak or talk about it. That person, I think, on balance of probability, would normally want to die. And take an even clearer case where I have I've expressed my wishes in writing that I want to die if certain conditions are met. You are day-to-day violating my dignity by forcing me to lie there in extreme pain, in a vegetal state, unable to do any of the things that I love, unable to recognize the people that I love. That is an insult to my life. It isn't at all a respect for my dignity.
Dylan, good morning. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hey, CBS. Yeah, Dylan, your favorite Zionist here again. Okay, so look, I'm going to start off with a quick philosophical question. You walk into a town, and there's 20 people handcuffed together. Someone says she has a gun. You shoot one person, the other 19 people get to live. There will be no repercussions. You're set free. But if you don't shoot one person, I will shoot all 20 of them. So let's look at the human level. As I said, I'm an Orthodox Jew, and, you know, forget about religion, forget about law. I've personally experienced the tragedy of someone suffering. My mother passed away from pancreatic cancer. It was her third cancer. From diagnosis to death was 6 weeks, and we had hospice involved and everything, and the pain she was in. I promise you, Eusebius, all I wanted to do was take a pillow and smother her just to end her pain. Mm. So I'm completely for what's called active euthanasia, the right to die is active euthanasia. I'm completely for it because you get some people who suffer from, I mean, look at Steve Jobs. With all the money in the world,
yes,
pancreatic cancer, he managed to live for 4 years.
Mm.
And he was in a tremendous amount of pain. I mean, the pain of dying from cancer, from some of these diseases, we cannot imagine. So forget about religion, forget about law.
Yeah.
That's an academic point of view.
Yeah.
Let's look at it from a human point of view. Put yourself in someone's shoes or in their place who's feeling that pain.
That's right, yeah.
Surely they should have the right, unless they put a gun to their head and put a bullet in their head, which is suicide. And I don't see active euthanasia as assisted suicide. That's what they call it. That is incorrect. It's not assisted suicide. Okay? It's about ending something that a person can no longer bear. So to live with.
Yeah.
So I'm 100% for it. Mm.
Thanks for your articulation of those thoughts, Dylan. Out of interest, did Mom express any views on the matter?
No. She was a very proud person. She would never tell people when she was in pain and that kind of stuff. So she was a very strong person, and she didn't want to put any kind of inconvenience onto anyone, or inconvenience anyone for that matter. So she silently sat there in pain, and I could see the pain. But she didn't want to inconvenience me or anyone else and say, I need this or I need that. She just silently sat there, and she bared it, and she dealt with it, and she died. But the fact of the matter is, I think if she had the option, she would have chosen
it. Absolutely.
I stand to be corrected. I'm not her.
Sure.
But for me, if I was in her shoes,
yes,
I want that option.
You know, thanks, Dylan. Always love having you on the show. What Jacques, what Dylan is saying, so much comes up for me. Firstly, just at the level of affect, that he's right, isn't he? That this is also about humanism.
Yeah, it's precisely about humanism. And as we were discussing, the idea of letting people live and die in a way that respects their, not only their wishes, but their quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And not making the end of life a miserable place to be.
Yeah, yeah. Jumasani, good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Davis. I completely agree with people having the right to end their life on their own terms, especially if they're experiencing immense suffering. I think there are many factors at play here. Besides, religious people would believe that life is sacred and all of that. You must hold on to it no matter what, you know, all of these things. I think there's also a fetishization of suffering we have, not just in South Africa. I think just as people, there's a belief that it doesn't matter how much you suffer. You know, you need to go through it, even if it's just awful. Somehow that suffering makes you better, even if it's terminal cancer or whatever it is.
Mm.
There's a belief that if you fight and you hold on, you become a better person, and you become stronger all the time. Look, there are instances, right, where I can see that, the suffering does make you stronger, but sometimes, it really doesn't do anything for you. You just continue to suffer mindlessly, and you die under horrible conditions. You die while in a lot of pain. It's just not right.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, if you want to leave us your thoughts as a voice note, 0727021702. We'll take more of your calls as well. Really interesting questions here. How do you want to leave planet Earth? Do you want to have a say when and how you go? And do you think that law reform needs to happen in South Africa to allow for so-called assisted suicide? And I totally agree with Dylan as well. It's a useful shorthand, some of the terminology that we use, but we also perpetuate, I think, some of the stigma. We know what you think about suicide per se. And so even the phrase assisted suicide, I think, partly conjures up all sorts of moralism in this area that perhaps is part of the problem.
Know, live, transform. This is 702. This is 702. For the curious.
28 minutes before 11 o'clock. Jacques, it's quite interesting, right? Because in this case of Professor Davison, there was a plea bargain entered into. As you correctly remarked in your blog entry, of course, there are no hard rules, even where there are minimum sentencing guidelines. You can, under exceptional circumstances, jurisprudentially, as a jurist, depart from them, as a judge Lauper has allowed for. You then make the other observation, which, as a general principle, I would agree with, that sometimes societal attitudes lag behind a progressive judgment, and we got to be very careful and tactical from an activism point of view how we go about getting society to rethink an issue, and eventually law reform happens. I know this is very anecdotal, but it's really interesting what's happening on our Twitter timelines, mine and yours, and the callers that we're getting. It may be that this is an area that is actually ripe for law reform and public hearings.
I think it certainly is, and as I did remark in that entry, it's a great pity that Deirdre Carter won't be around to carry on with the fight, because she was precisely going to try to get durable power of attorney and living wills in this regard recognized in this current parliament. But we should, and it's the people like you and I who are activists for this cause, should recognize that it, initially it might only be possible to get public support for something like assisted dying, so something which is just a step up from palliative care. And you start with that, and the Overton window shifts, and people become accustomed to that, and later on you might be able to provide active euthanasia or whatever, yes, whatever the progression is that one imagines. But one doesn't start in politics with your ultimate goal if it's something as controversial and emotively loaded as this.
Absolutely. Mary, good morning. Thank you so much for calling in.
Good morning. I'm quite happy that we're discussing the subject because I'm suffering from a disease which is incurable and made the decision to go to Switzerland, treatment house. Everything is already organized. And I'm just waiting for my last authorization from them because they're taking this very seriously. But everything is now fine. And at the end of next month, I'll be on my way.
And what do you say to people who think that this is playing God or they just don't understand these decisions, Mary?
I really couldn't care less what other people think. I mean, really, it's my decision, my life, and I want my end to be the way I want it, not how other people think I should live or die. It's my personal decision, and really, I have no interest in other people's opinions.
Thank you for sharing that, Mary.
All right.
Jacques, what comes up for you as you listen to Mary?
I'm afraid that the line is quite indistinct from this side. I think I agreed with what she was saying, but I can't offer any nuance quickly because I didn't really.
She's in the process of choosing this option for herself, she said, and this is going to play out in the next couple of weeks, months, and she quite frankly doesn't care what other people think, she says, on the question of other people's assumptions that she's playing God with her own life.
I have great respect for that, and I wish her success. I wish her well, and hope that she finds the support that she needs, and courageous people who are willing to help her through this, and in a way that respects her and her choices.
Absolutely, Mavusana.
Hi, UCDS. Hi to Jack. Also, I was also of the opinion that it is immoral and all sorts of stuff when somebody prefers or wishes to die in a dignified manner. So I was against euthanasia until it happened to somebody very dear to me. My mom fell ill and she had cancer of the stomach. And, just to see her deteriorate the way that she did. And, you could see the body was giving in, but the mind was still fine and sharp. And she wouldn't express that she wants to go up until right at the end where she just couldn't bear the pain anymore. And for all of us, it was, if she lives, let her live. If she dies, please let her die. But whatever, just make it quick. We just couldn't bear the pain of seeing the trauma of seeing her in pain. So, and like your guest says, it's unfortunate that most people like myself have to go through such a traumatic event for them to adjust their mindset about it. But like your guest said, the ground is ripe now and fertile. I think a lot of people have gone through seeing their loved ones suffer in pain. And I think it is time now that people be given a choice.
100%. Jacques, can we shift in between taking calls to just another theme? I think, and you spend a lot of time thinking, amongst other things, about public discourse. There are certain topics we do not know how to handle, certain topics we do not even speak about, right? And maybe this is even going beyond so-called assisted suicide as such, but it is still in the realm of death and dying. We don't have much public conversation around death and dying outside of a interesting, quirky 2 or 3 week undergraduate philosophy module you might take on ethics. And that's part of the problem, isn't it? I mean, we need to learn to be able to speak about dying. After all, it's the only certainty in life, more certain than taxes.
Yeah, we certainly do. And I mean, here I think we can tell a kind of cultural evolution story that helps us to make sense of it. Dying is now less of a problem. And what I mean by that is that we were dependent on each other in ways in the past, which we perhaps aren't now, because we have healthcare, or many of us have healthcare, and extended families and communication and access to resources and so forth. So dying was something to be feared because it left you bereft of any other options in life.
Yes.
Now we're going to live for longer and longer, and that's some people aren't grappling with, is the fact that we might solve disease or cure disease to such an extent that we're living to 150. Yeah. We're going to get bored. We might not be working because AI is doing our jobs.
I know, yeah. And at some point, I want to bring you back because a different conversation. I'm mindful that we don't want to, particularly from an activism point of view, try and get more gains than we will get in the present moment on this conversation. But there are many other circumstances beyond suffering. I know suffering is being centered in this conversation. Many people have horrific experiences of, for example, dying as a result of 3 or 4 cancers. But there are also other ethical questions around suicide, life, meaningful life that we need to return to, and where I think public sentiment is even further behind. Karen, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Eusebius. Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm really very strong-minded about this. I believe that we should be able to go the way we want to go and when we want to go. So I have many, many times told my children that when I believe I'm done, then I'm going to have a gin and pool party. Now, this might sound funny, but it's not funny. It's where I possibly am older and I can't take care of myself. My mind's going, my body's going, my finances are going. I would rather have my family around me and we have a happy send-off. I take whatever I take and goodbye and I'm out of here. So I've got huge respect for Mary, but I'm sad for her that she needs to go all the way to Switzerland to go through this process. She shouldn't have to go all that way overseas, leave her friends and family behind because it's a very, very expensive thing, obviously. And she should have the right to do it in her home, in her bed, with her family, with her pets, and say, I'm done. This is my choice, and goodbye.
Karen, I couldn't have said it better. And the whole point of preserving that dignity that Jacques was talking about earlier is that that dignity in part finds expression in familial relations, friendship, and that is what you want to preserve even in the final moments. And so the idea of traveling abroad introduces a kind of alienation that is part of what you are trying to not experience.
Correct. So I have said, this is what I'm going to do. I will go and I'll get a handful. And trust me, there will be people that will support me and help me and give me whatever I need to do. And I will take that and I will have a sandal. And this is what maybe when others say to me, well, this is what you've been saying all the time. When the time comes, you won't be able to do it. But I strongly believe that I will, because then I will have served my purpose and I'll be happy to go and I'll say, you know, and I don't even think I'm going to see them wherever, but I've done what I needed to do.
I would ask you this question before I let you go. Just on the issue that I've just spoken to Jacques about, having the conversation about death, opening up that conversation with kids, with relatives, with whoever, what has opening it up done? What was the act of being in conversation with them about the topic like?
Well, I started by being jovial about it, you know, saying, oh, when I hit 70, then I'm going to have a gin and pool party and I'm going to get out of here. Because it's always played on my mind that, when it's time to go, I want to go, you know, and so they kind of got used to it. And I think that they know what I mean and they know that I mean what I'm saying.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't think to start the conversation being morbid, I've had enough, I want to get out of here. I don't think that's the way. I think one's got to be open about it and just speak why. Put your reasons there, saying, you know, for finances, for health, for whatever, you know, make it easy for everybody. and specifically for myself, and I don't think that that is a selfish thing at all, because we live for ourselves, you know, and we've got to bear whatever we live with ourselves.
Thank you, Karen. That's absolutely stunning. So many things there to worth picking up. One thing for me there, Jacques, is that, and I really do believe this, it does not have to be a dreary conversation, does it?
No, it doesn't have to be at all. And I love that call and the sentiments of it. And what it brings to mind is that when we speak about that dignity and so forth, we aren't foregrounding the suffering of the bystanders in us either.
Yes.
I mean, I, like a previous caller, had to watch my mother die for 4 or 5 years, I can't recall. But that stuff is also quite unpleasant. And if the person on the other end wants to have a final party and go out with a smile and so forth while they still have the strength and the ability to do so, that's a glorious, life-affirming, humanistic moment.
Yes. Barbara, good morning. Thank you so much for holding on.
Good morning, Eusebius. Eusebius, my story was a little bit different to the previous people, if you'd like me to go ahead and tell you.
Yes.
I actually did assist my grandfather in 1992, and I had been unable to talk about it for fear of being arrested, being taken to trial on it. So I really had to remain quiet for most of these years. Mm. But it was my grandfather's request, and he did not want to go on. He was riddled with emphysema. Uh-huh. He had pancreatic cancer. He had prostate cancer. And he was almost full-blown HIV, having contracted it through my gran from many operations she'd had through surgery for her neck. And we had discussed it for 6 months. I nursed him for 6 months. My mom had died when I was young, so there was nobody else to assist him. And we discussed this many times. I was 23 years old. I was young. And, you know, it was just one of those things that you do for people when they're living in that much pain.
Absolutely.
So I did. I assisted him. I didn't know what it was called really then. There weren't that many names given, you know. Assisted suicide was what I really believed it was.
Yes. And what did Grant say to you? Did he first open up the conversation?
He did. He had lost his wife. Mm. He had lost his only child. He had lost his brother. And it was brought up a few times. He didn't know whether he should use a blade, cut his wrists. There was a number of ways he thought of doing it. And if I'm allowed to tell you how he did it, I can tell you. Maybe I shouldn't tell you on the radio. If I can, I will.
You can tell us your truth, Barbara. What happened?
We eventually, you know, we had to source, it was a neighboring country, it wasn't in South Africa, for fear of being prosecuted, I didn't say a word. We had to collect a lot of his medication from all over the country because at the time there were a lot of sanctions.
Mm.
He eventually used the rest of the sleeping tablets he had, they were called Mogadon, and I watched him. I'd actually put my back up that morning, putting him into a wheelchair, and the wheelchair fell forward. And as I went to catch him, I put my back out, and he decided that was the morning he was going to do it. Mm. And it was a Wednesday morning, and I sat there. Two friends of ours came down, which he discussed it in front of these friends. So he was adamant he was going to do it. He was of sane mind. His body had failed him, not his mind.
Yes.
And he just decided that was it. And I sat there through the window. He eventually, because he was immobile, he was staying kind of like on a veranda where we'd had a port-a-loo for him, where we could swing him onto a port-a-loo. And I sat there and I watched him swallow 59 Mogadon tablets until his stomach was so distended because he was weighing about 42 kilos. The inhumane part of watching a person die is when they're elderly, their teeth no longer fit them, their false teeth. And they don't want to live like that. They don't want to live with crapping their pants every day, soiling their beds.
Yes.
It is just not fair to watch them die like that.
There's no dignity. The inherent self-worth that we are endowed with at birth, even though the Constitution says it is inherent in us, that is legal text. How you feel on the inside is different depending on what stage of your life you're at.
You see, this is no dignity. You know, when you find someone trying to dig their feces out with a teaspoon because their stomachs no longer work, there is no dignity left.
Barra, I just want to ask you one question, right? So firstly, thank you for sharing the story and talking about it for the first time so bravely. Secondly, I'm no Desmond Tutu. For what it's worth, I think you behaved ethically, above and ethical reproach. What you did was completely, as far as I'm concerned, ethically permissible and justified. I want to ask you this question. Jacques spoke about also the suffering of us as family members, as bystanders. You've had to help with granddad's dying. You've also now had to live with the story and carry it across in your own memory, your psychology, your body, across time and space. What was that like with so much public ignorance, shaming and silence around this conversation?
The silence, the cliche that is deafening, is so true, because there are so many people that when they argue their case, they are ignorant of what that suffering for those people are really, really like. The suffering for the families to watch that. If they really had to understand that suffering, they too would look at it from a different perspective.
Absolutely.
Because to know it is to understand it. And I would be there behind Dignity SA all the way. If I could talk about it without fear of prosecution, I would be behind them all the way.
Thank you, Barbara. Love and light to you. Thank you for calling in.
Eusebius Makaiza.
Eusebius Makaiza.
On 702.
If you are this time here from Alberton, you know, hey, this thing is so complicated, but from my own side, I think it must not put in law, because I remember by myself in 2013, I was sick to a way that I was like a skeleton and I was losing hope every day. But here I am today. I think if I was going to take that decision, baby, it was going to be more than may allow me to have chances of surviving. So I don't think it must be allowed to be in law. Thanks.
Well, thank you to Anonymous for that call. And I wonder what Jacques makes of it. This is what I make of it. A couple of things. One individual experience isn't the basis of public policy. So if you recovered through good fortune, luck, or medical treatment or medical breakthrough, it doesn't follow from that that the policy shouldn't be enacted, because the policy may still have instances when it should apply. But the second thing, and I hope this point won't come across as too academic or philosophical, is that Anonymous, if you had decided that you wanted to go when you experienced that horror, it's not obvious to me that that choice would have been an irrational choice with the benefit of hindsight. Because, and I don't know your case history, because things change over time. Let's take, for example, living with AIDS. If you were one of the early folks to be, unfortunately, succumbing to AIDS, let's say, in the 80s, it's a very different society into which you, in which you find yourself than in 2019, when it's a manageable chronic condition to live with the HIV virus in your body. And frankly, cancer is a scarier diagnosis than being told you're HIV positive. Jacques, what comes up for you? We've got to be careful about these cases, right? I mean, I respect his personal fact that he's survived to be able to say, "Yo, thank God. The option wasn't available, I would have taken it." But that's not how we determine public policy.
No, it's not. And I mean, I also sympathize and with the call, but the exceptions can't drive the policy, and mistakes are going to be made. But the point, as I was saying earlier on, is that mistakes are currently being made, and we need to count those as well. So people who are anti any kind of assisted dying are all talking about that anonymous sort of perspective, but they're not recognizing the suffering that is going on every day of people being forced to stay alive. We've got to count that as well. And if we can minimize any kinds of abuses of the thing, then on balance, we are resulting in a far more a far better moral calculus than we currently have. One can't just ignore one half of this whole balance.
Absolutely. Leon, our last caller on this topic, keep it short for me. We are running out of time.
Okay, mate. Thanks a lot. I want to know, what's the difference between a living will and assisted suicide? Somebody says, I'm in pain, I want to go. And then you turn off the plug. But at the same time, you know, you can't kill somebody. I mean, isn't that the same thing?
Let's get away from the terminology, I would say, Leon. The key point of this discussion is very simple. should the law criminalize someone for assisting another human being who has expressed a desire that they no longer want to live, once we've put safeguards in place to make sure that we don't have an abuse of the policy? It really is that simple. Your final thought, Jacques, I'll give you 30 seconds.
Okay, thanks. People need to remember that a refusal to grant a peer request expressed in a competent state is the most obvious example of playing God. And we can't use the playing God excuse without considering that. Secondly, palliative care will be suitable for the vast majority of cases. We don't need to think that there's going to be an onslaught of this sort of thing, because physicians don't want to kill people, and the vast majority of people don't want to kill others either. If you have religious objections, you don't have to do it, but the law should be secular.
Absolutely. Jacques, excellent reflections as always. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I always appreciate having you on.
Thanks, Cecilia, and thanks to the callers.
Absolutely. Most importantly to the callers, you were stunning. Thanks for allowing yourself to be vulnerable to thinking about a difficult ethical issue. And this is the magic that you and I create every single day. Jacques Rousseau, of course, he is a lecturer in critical thinking at the University of Cape Town.